From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In just 28 hours now, the polls open in Iraq. The election is effectively under siege. The stakes for the country and for each voter may literally be life and death. Insurgents have promised to kill anyone who votes. Millions of Sunnis are boycotting. Those who take the risk and head to the polls will vote for members of a new 275-seat National Assembly. They will also elect 18 provincial councils and, in the north, a 111-member Kurdish Regional Assembly. The newly elected National Assembly will pick a president and two deputy presidents, then, if all goes to plan, draft a permanent constitution by August 15th. Security measures being taken to protect the vote are intense. Iraq's borders have been closed and travel between provinces banned. A nationwide curfew has been imposed from 7 p.m. till 6 in the morning. Despite the lockdown, insurgent violence is widespread. At least five U.S. soldiers killed in Baghdad today. Iraqi security forces killed. Residents of Ramadi reporting six members of the Shia community there beheaded. Polling stations attacked across the country. A U.S. base shelled south of the capital. No word yet on what caused another U.S. helicopter to go down in South Baghdad today. And no word yet on the fate of its crew. Tonight on Point, Iraq on the bloody eve of elections and the hopes and fears surrounding Sunday's vote. We begin in Baghdad with a pair of Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters, Anthony Shadid, Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post, and John Burns, Baghdad bureau chief for The New York Times. I asked John to sum up the situation in Iraq with the election less than 2 days away.
The good news from the point of view of the United States and its hopes for an election that will produce some kind of progress towards an American military withdrawal is that in the north and the south is very widespread enthusiasm for this election, candidates out in the streets and rallies and rather limited trouble in terms of insurgent attacks. That means that we can look forward, I think, to a fairly heavy turnout in the northern areas in Kurdistan and the Shiite areas in the south. The bad news for the American prospects here is that in the Sunni heartland of Iraq and in Baghdad itself, the situation is extremely tense in the face of insurgent warnings to, as one of their brochures distributed in the Baghdad neighborhood the other day said, wash the streets with the blood of anybody who attempts to vote. The United States military and Iraqi security forces have poured police and soldiers into these contested areas in the hope of encouraging a vote, creating security conditions in which people might vote. But the restrictions and the disincentives are very severe indeed, not the least of which is with a ban on motor traffic and an attempt to inhibit suicide car bombing, people are going to have to walk to the polls. In many cases, people don't know where the polls are yet. They've not been formally identified, although most of them be in schools. And beyond that, many people don't even know who's running. They don't really know one party from another. And since the candidate lists have been kept blind, they don't even know who is actually running for each party.
Anthony Shadid, John Burns gives us the good and bad news from the U.S. perspective there. What are you hearing from Iraqis about their hopes, about their fears for Sunday's elections?
Well, like John said, I think it's definitely a different story wherever you are. You do hear some enthusiasm in places like Basra, Iraq's second largest city. There's a sense that it's a moment for the Shia community after decades, even centuries of oppression, and now they're able to put forth their voice on how these elections go. You know, it's much grimmer, and like John pointed out, in Baghdad or in central Iraq, where the Sunnis have a majority. It's not as much even resentment. It's a certain level of apathy. And in some neighborhoods of Baghdad, it's rare to see posters for candidates in Sunni areas. Whether it's intimidation that they don't want to vote or that it's a perception that this election is engineered by the United States and they don't want to be part of it, it's probably a little of both to explain that. But I think you can definitely see a tale of two Iraqs on Election Day, one that's bought into this process and sees a step forward, another sees this as more manipulation on the part of the United States.
John Burns, you and Anthony have both spent some time talking with Iraqis recently about their personal involvement or attitude toward the vote on Sunday. You spoke in Baghdad with a dentist, 46 years old, Sunni, named Rad al-Nakib. Give us a sense of how this one Iraqi, was looking at Sunday's vote. What's his perspective on it and the American involvement?
Well, he's the kind of Iraqi that the United States felt they could build the new Iraq around. An opponent of Saddam Hussein, an intellectual, an educated man, a man who has civic values, but Dr. al-Nakib is not going to vote. He's not going to vote in the first place because he thinks it's too dangerous. And I think there are a lot of other people who will feel like it. Not because he's a Sunni. He's a Sunni moderate, and he's a man with secular values, and he just thinks it's too dangerous. In addition to which, he did speak at some length about how little the campaign has really revealed. There have been television debates, which have been quite eagerly watched, but there's been nothing that you could call in Baghdad, at least, any real campaigning. And as I said before, the parties, for security reasons, have not even disclosed their candidate list. If you have access to the internet, you can find out who they are, but you can't go and find the names of the candidates posted on the walls, except in a few cases of party leaders whose names are pasted on the walls on posters. So there's a general feeling that this is not really an open, transparent, accessible contest, and that's also factoring into the widespread disaffection for the entire process.
And your 46-year-old dentist in Baghdad also had some tough words for American forces there, who were trying to keep order, but he said he sees them as, to quote him, part of the terrorism. What did he mean by that?
Well, the United States Armed Forces are in a very difficult position here, and it ill behooves people like myself who live under the umbrella of American military security to cavil too much at what they do. But the fact is that they have taken some very tough measures. I'm talking now about the general run of American military operations and not, of course, of the public relations catastrophe, the real disaster of Abu Ghraib, which is well remembered here. I'll give you one example of the things that they have been forced to do, which I'm sure they would rather not do. In the face of the suicide car bombing threat, which has been pretty severe around Baghdad, and the principal target of the suicide car bombers are American military convoys, the rear gunners of American military convoys, usually in Humvees, have been ordered or licensed to warn motorists approaching them from behind, throw water bottles at them, show hand signals, fire at the engines of cars if they continue to approach, and if the vehicles continue to come on, to fire at the driver with intent to kill. And this has happened in enough cases now that there is a very widespread apprehension and unhappiness about this. And, of course, in a climate like this, when people are afraid, paranoid in many cases, the incidence of this kind of thing is exaggerated. We don't have any precise figures on it, but it does happen, and every time it happens, an entire neighborhood, an entire community is traumatized by it, and it does generate considerable hostility towards the American forces. I think that's what was being reflected in what Dr. Nakib said. But I have to say that if you go on to say to Dr. Nakib, well, would you want the American troops to be withdrawn, he, like so many other critics of American forces, will say, no, for God's sake, no. That will only precipitate a civil war. They have to stay here long enough to create conditions under which Iraq can, in effect, take over its own security.
And yet, and maybe to that point, he's too frightened to go and vote on Sunday, and for that matter, doesn't even know the names of who he might be voting for. Anthony Shadid, in southern Iraq, you had quite a different experience talking with Sheikh Adnan Aidani. He's out openly campaigning. People know exactly who he is, what his number is on the ballot, and he wants their vote. He's telling them so.
Right. He's in a difficult situation. He's a tribal sheikh. He has authority that comes from tradition in the area, 12,000 people who had identified themselves with his tribe down there. And he's running on a list that's separate from the United Iraqi Alliance, which is an electoral coalition that's perceived by Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the country's most influential religious leader. He's a minority within Iraq Shia majority, basically, and he's running up against the juggernaut that is the Sistani-list campaign. And it's a losing battle, which he admits in the end.
you know, often the vote in southern Iraq is portrayed as much religious as it is political, and it looks to history as much as to the future. In other words, it's a lot of people in the Shiite community will see this vote as their moment to redress the wrongs that have happened in past decades, even past centuries. It's a long narrative of suffering and martyrdom. That's a powerful appeal, especially in southern Iraq, where memories of the uprising after the 1991 Gulf War still remain very vivid to a lot of people. Again, this is their moment, and because there is such an influence, and because Ayatollah Sistani does carry such clout in southern Iraq among Shiites, it's hard to see a list like that. And I think you're going to see a divide in some ways between urban and rural. In urban areas, you see a surprising amount of support for interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. People who see him as somewhat technocratic, a strong leader, kind of a law and order candidate. But then when you get into the countryside, in areas that are more traditional, more conservative, like I said, the clout of Sistani carries a lot of weight there. And people often may vote just because they think they're obeying their religious leaders rather than voting on the recommendations of a list or the strength of a list itself.
John Burns, insurgents are promising very loudly to kill anyone who goes to vote on Sunday. Under that threat, first of all, what kind of turnout is expected, and can these elections have sufficient credibility to change the political dynamic, the chaotic political dynamic we've seen in Iraq so far?
What I've noticed in talking to the people we go to for opinion, whether American or Iraqi, the people who we, in your phrase, look down on this from 30,000 feet, is that almost all of them answer a question like that by a shrug of the shoulder, and they say, who knows? The uncertainties that cloud all of this are really very great indeed. We've had a poll amongst the correspondents of the New York Times and photographers gathered here among ourselves on what we think the national turnout is likely to be, and it ranges from as little as 18% to 55%. It's really extremely difficult to predict what the turnout will be, but given the likely heavy turnout in the North and the South, even a substantial boycott staying away from the polls in central Iraq and in the Sunni Triangle might not be bring that turnout down to levels which would be a severe embarrassment. You might still get, even in the face of a boycott and in the Sunni Triangle and the turnout in Baghdad, or shall we say 10 or 12%, you might still get a national turnout in the 40s or 50s. We'll have to see. Would this add legitimacy to the process? I think it would. I think, again, a lot of uncertainties, but even the people who have seemed to be until now as polarizing forces, for example, the Shiite clerics with backing from Iran, have begun to, if you will, follow a kind of integrating principle in the last week or two, putting out signals that they do not want clerics in the government, they don't want turbans sitting around the cabinet table, that they will reach out to Sunnis, even if the Sunni vote is very low, that they're all Iraqis. And so I think that there's some hope that this process will gain legitimacy. The problem, of course, is that the insurgents reject the entire process. They have no political project of their own except, back to the future. And it's difficult to see that anything that's going to happen on Sunday is going to affect the insurgency or indeed hold back what on the whole has been, a worsening trend.
And Anthony Shadid, in the minute we have left, many Americans are quietly hoping for some change in the chemistry of Iraq to come out of this vote. Is there a chance for a meaningful outcome here? Is it made absurd by the violence and the boycott? How do you see it?
Well, it's difficult to say what a meaningful outcome would be. I mean, I think when you get down to it, there's a difficult situation the American military is in, because as long as the military is here, they're going to be a source of resentment and a source that propels forward the insurgency. Like John pointed out, if they left precipitously, it would probably exacerbate sectarian and ethnic strife here. So there's a real question on how you navigate that issue. The military being here making the situation worse, and the military leaving and making the situation worse. I'm not sure the answer to that, but I don't think there's any question that the insurgency will continue, that the election itself won't provide any impetus for a decrease in the violence.
We're very grateful to both of you for being with us tonight, Anthony Shadid and John Burns in Baghdad. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. John Birds is Baghdad bureau chief for The New York Times. They spoke with me from Baghdad. We're talking tonight about Sunday's vote. What do you think? What are your expectations for this election? 1-800-423-8255. Much more to come. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq on the bloody eve of elections there and the hopes and fears surrounding Sunday's vote. You can join the conversation. What are your expectations of Iraq's vote? Is this a first step on the path to democracy or a damaged, even doomed political exercise? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Hearing both caution and a note of hope there, I would say, from our correspondents in Baghdad. A lot is riding on this vote, but the environment is widely lethal. Many candidates have not even publicized their names. We've heard from correspondents in Iraq, but we also want to hear how the election is being viewed more widely in the Middle East. Rami Khoury is executive editor of the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper. He's written about good news and bad news in the run-up to Sunday's election. I asked Rami Khoury how he sees the looming good and bad.
Well, the bad news is pretty obvious, and many people have been saying it for a couple of years now. This is an election that is spawned by an occupation, an American-British-led war to change the regime, a situation with excuses or rationales that prove to be not true, weapons of mass destruction. And it is a situation that is fraught with opposition to the American presence. It's everything the Americans have done politically in Iraq, virtually everything has brought about great resistance from many, many people in Iraq, in the Arab world, and around the whole world. So all the negatives are known. We've been talking about these for several years now. The positive side of it is that despite all of these things, you have an opportunity here possibly for the Iraqis to start electing a legitimate government. If a majority of Iraqis sees this as a legitimate process, then the clock starts ticking to the Americans getting out of Iraq and the Iraqis finally being able to reconstitute their country in the manner that they want to do it. That's a big if. We don't know if a majority of Iraqis are going to see this election as legitimate. Most of the leadership process in Iraq in the last 2 years has been seen as pretty illegitimate, I think, by most people in the Middle East. It's seen as an American appointed and an American run system. So this is the potential turning point.
How are people from around the Middle East looking on at this election? Elections are not common in your part of the world. How's it being seen, described? Are reformers pointing to it as something great? Is it being decried here today after tomorrow because the American soldiers are there? What kind of regional reception is it getting?
I think there's, again, a very mixed reception. There's a lot of skepticism about a democratic election that is fostered at the gunpoint of the American army. So there's tremendous skepticism politically to the whole context in which this is happening, with the regime change and the war and the Americans reshaping the map of the Middle East, as they say, and all of these things. So great skepticism and, I think, opposition politically throughout the region. There are some people, maybe 5-10% of people around the Middle East, who say that you need an external push like this. You need an external factor to shake up the Arab world and to help the people address their problems and get on with the process of modernization. So there's a small minority of people who says this is the right way to do it, but the vast majority, I think, are apprehensive. There are regimes, I think, in ruling elites that are concerned throughout the region, because one of the things that the war in Iraq has done is to show their vulnerability as regimes, and perhaps even their very mixed legitimacy as regimes in many parts of the Arab world. So I think there is concern also that, in a funny way, that if this election works and you start a process that might take a couple of years, in which you have real self-determination and democracy and stability and prosperity in Iraq, it would embolden the Americans, especially in the second Bush administration, it would embolden them to say, all right, it worked, we did it. Let's start pressuring other regimes in the region to open up their systems and to become more democratic and liberal. So there are many levels, I think, of concern
around the region for what is happening in Iraq.
You've said that there is, on the good news side, the chance, however modest that may be, a real chance that a genuine sense of sovereignty and normalcy could begin to emerge after this election. Though we see you're painting a picture that's fraught with problems here. What will be the tests for whether or not this election is getting Iraq on a better track?
I think the test will be within the 3 or 4 months after the election. If you start building up a momentum within Iraq, first of all, a sense of a consensus on political legitimacy, that the elected people in this parliament have credibility, have legitimacy, are seen to be really representing the views of the Iraqi people, and then that those people start putting together a constitution and a power-sharing governance system that is seen by Iraqis to be fair and reasonable and accurately reflecting both of their identity, cultural, social, ethnic, religious identities, national identity, and also helping them develop a governance system that respects their basic needs and rights and aspirations as Iraqi citizens. That's a call that the Iraqi people are going to have to make. It's not going to be a question of how many percentage, did 50% or 60% vote, did the Sunnis boycott, did the Kurds do this, did the Shias do this. I think it's a much more nuanced process, and I think the criteria are not what happens on the election day, Sunday. The criteria are really what happens in the 3 to 4 months after that, and will this process start a timetable to get the foreign troops out of Iraq. It's a combination of those things that will determine if this is a successful political transition or not.
You're saying within 3 to 4 months after the election, those things will become clear. But how will they become clear? The U.S. military is already projecting that there's going to be plenty more violence, many more insurgent attacks on the other side of the election. In the absence of a further vote or some kind of public expression, what will be the indicators of whether or not the government produced by this election is gaining legitimacy?
Well, I think the indicators are going to be a combination of mood and fact. I mean, the mood is going to be in terms of people's participation. They're speaking out. They're getting involved in the public process of politics. And the facts are going to be things like the security situation. I mean, only the Iraqis in the end are going to bring about security in their country. You can put in another 150,000 American and foreign troops, and that's just going to increase the resistance. It's not going to decrease it. So if the Iraqis themselves feel that they are taking charge of their own country and that the people doing this in Iraq, the Iraqis, are designing a system of governance that is representative, that is fair, that is equitable, that is inclusive, they themselves will then generate a political momentum which will allow the Iraqi security services and the armed forces to increase security, and that will take away the support for the kinds of attacks that you're seeing now, which are mostly against Iraqis. The attacks are not so much against Americans. They're mostly against Iraqi security forces. Only a sense of legitimacy of governance will provide the momentum by which Iraqis themselves in the security services and in society as a whole will be able to beat the people involved in whether you call it an insurgency or resistance or terrorism or whatever you want to call it. I think those will be the signs that we look for. Another sign is significant economic investment. Another sign is going to be restoration of full basic services, electricity, water, transport. Another sign is how safe is it for people to travel on the roads? Will people get involved in cultural activities? And this is just the signs of normal life. You know, this is not rocket science. We're not reinventing the wheel here. This is very simple stuff. And, you know, the Iraqis have more experience in this than anybody else in the whole world. They have about 6,000 years of experience in human civilization and in urban civilization. So there's nobody in the world who has more experience in nationhood, statehood, and governance than the people of Iraq.
Rami, you've described U.S. involvement there as romantically naive and frighteningly amateurish, a farce, in your words. In the past 24 hours, President Bush has said that he expects Iraqi leaders will want U.S. forces to stay to help out, and he intends to have them there if that's what they want. Senator Ted Kennedy has become the first U.S. senator to call for a pullout of U.S. troops. Which is more helpful?
I think you need something in the middle. I don't think President Bush would know an Iraqi leader if he had lunch with him, because there are no legitimate Iraqi leaders today in power, really. you only have American-appointed administrator, caretaker administrators. The people running Iraq today do not have significant widespread legitimacy among their own people. That's why the majority of Iraqis are anxious to get a democratic process going so they can choose their own people and not have to put up with people appointed by the Americans.
And in fairness, the president was referring to the government he expects to emerge from Sunday's election.
If the election is seen to be legitimate, see, it's a big if. We don't know. It may prove to be a farce. If only a small number of people get involved, if you have a huge boycott, if people are elected who are seen to have been elected because the American army helped them campaign or American institutions gave them money, we don't know if the people who are elected are going to put together a constitution that's going to be seen to be fair by the Iraqi people.
The key is to start the process of Iraqi self-determination, to start the process of transferring authority from the foreign military occupation to the indigenous Iraqis who were chosen by their own people and accountable to their own people. If that happens, and I think the Americans can help this gain legitimacy by announcing very quickly a preliminary timetable for American withdrawal to make it clear that the U.S. is not going to stay as a military presence or occupier or administrator or helper for a long time in Iraq. So an American announcing of a phased withdrawal would also push, I think, the Iraqis to work harder to take charge of their own destiny. It would be a positive stimulus, I think, for Iraqi society as a whole to rally around the elected leaders and the new institutions of governance and to really take command of their own future. So that's what I think. You can't just announce that you're getting out in 6 months or say that you're going to stay there as long as you need to get the job done. You've got to announce something in between where you're making the point that the American army is going to be leaving and orderly transfer of authority to the Iraqis. And something like that, I think, makes the most sense.
Something in between, and then pray that the elections begin to produce some kind of government legitimacy there. Rami Khoury in Beirut, always great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Rami Khoury is executive editor of the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper. He spoke with me from Beirut. We are talking tonight about Iraq on the bloody eve of elections and the hopes and fears surrounding Sunday's vote. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Sunnyvale, California, is Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of political science at Stanford University, director of the Democracy Program at Stanford's Institute for International Studies. From January to April last year, he served as a senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. Larry Diamond, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Good evening.
And with us tonight from Arlington, Virginia, Anthony Cordesman, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He served as national security assistant to Senator John McCain in the Senate Armed Services Committee and has worked in both the State Department and Department of Defense. Anthony Cordesman, good to have you tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
First to you, Mr. Cordesman, if I may, what will you be watching for in the Sunday vote and its aftermath?
Well, obviously, we need to watch the turnout. We need to understand the turnout because there are security problems. There are also physical problems. There are only about half the polling places that were originally planned, and Iraq is not a place that it's easy to travel in, even if you don't have security problems. It's important to know how many people voted in what areas so we get some idea of the split between Sunni and Shiite and Kurd. And then we need to watch what it really means when the election results are announced, which is going to take probably about 10 days to do a full count. And then we need to understand how the lists work. But one of the key things that is really a problem here is that this new National Assembly has to elect a presidency council. All three presidents, the president and the two vice presidents, have to basically cooperate on all major issues, including nominating a prime minister, who then has to be approved by the new National Assembly, and who has to either retain or basically fire 28 ministers, all of whom are going to be signs of how power is going to be shared.
Mm-hmm.
And how inclusive things are going to be, because these ministers don't have to be members of the National Assembly and can be Sunni. And if this is beginning to sound complicated, it is. You're really not going to understand the impact of the election for probably a month after the results come in.
That's a long time to wait with everything that's going on, but I suppose with the horse trading that's going to come after, to expect anything quicker would be difficult, though we'll see how the violence turns out on Election Day. Larry Diamond, you were with us about, what, 10 days ago, a week or 10 days ago. You said you fear a calamity in the making in Iraq. How does the election factor into your assessment?
Well, the problem is, and Anthony Cordesman has alluded to this, it's not just a question of the overall turnout. It's a question of the disparity in turnout between some sections of the country and others, and in particular the disparity between most of the Shiite South and probably virtually all of the Kurdish North, except perhaps the border areas, where turnout, I think, will be very heavy in these areas that are more or less physically secure. People are going to vote in very large numbers. And with the kind of democratic enthusiasm, if the administrative glitches get worked out, that President Bush has envisioned, they want to vote. They want to choose their government.
The State Department said in an internal poll in December that they expect 32% of Sunnis to vote, 87% of Shiites. And, of course, Shiites are a much larger percentage of the population, 60% of the population. Do those sound, given what we're seeing in Iraq, do those sound like reasonable expectations to you at this point?
Yeah, the only thing I would say is it may be high for the Sunnis. I mean, you know, you may have effectively no voting at all in large sections of the Sunni triangle. And I just really worry about the result, because what's going to happen in a system that's using the electoral method of proportional representation in a nationwide list, where every list will get seats only in proportion to its national vote, is that the Sunnis are going to be wildly underrepresented in the National Assembly.
There's been a lot of talk about horse trading to be done after the election. Okay, they don't get voted, we'll figure out a way to get them involved. Do you think that can make up the difference, close the gap?
There are two problems here. One is, yes, they can bring them into the cabinet, and they can bring them into the Constitutional Drafting Committee. People from outside the assembly can be brought in. But the two problems are, first of all, that they can't be brought into the assembly itself without a constitutional amendment. Very difficult to do. Requires three-quarters of the National Assembly. So will they settle for these forms of partial and perhaps other ad hoc forms of inclusion? Secondly, and very few people are really pondering this question, which Sunnis are we talking about? Ayad Alawi, who may be prime minister again, has brought Sunnis into his government, but he hasn't brought the Sunnis who are making the violence. And unless there is much more far-reaching negotiations that includes people who want to talk about political inclusion and who may be now sponsoring or at least condoning the violence, the insurgency will not end. And if the insurgency doesn't end, I think it's going to be very difficult to stabilize Iraq.
Larry Diamond, Anthony Cordesman, please stand by in Washington, in California. We're talking tonight about Iraq on the bloody eve of elections. You can join the conversation. Would you have the courage to turn out to vote in Baghdad on Sunday? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq on the eve of elections there and the hopes and fears surrounding Sunday's vote. We're joined tonight from Washington by Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and from California by Larry Diamond, Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. You can join us as well. Is this a first step on the path of democracy or a doomed political exercise? Would you have the guts to vote in Iraq on Sunday? 1-800-423-TALK. Sohail is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Sohail. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I would, for the most part, agree with your guest, Larry Diamond, on the picture he had painted.
What aspect, Sohail? In what regard?
The complexity of the situation.
Well, no kidding, but what do you mean?
Well, specifically how this election is going to be so difficult to produce the kind of the results which Americans would like to see, where the vote is extremely divided, and some areas may not even show any results.
Do you see greater legitimacy potentially emerging out of the vote, or something else?
Well, here is my comment to the situation looking at the future. I think this is leading to actually split of the Iraq, which is not necessarily bad, but I'm afraid that this is not the result which America was hoping for. But that's where the things are moving to.
You see it splitting up. Anthony Cordesman, you know the silent and explicit prayer of Americans is that somehow this begins to get Iraq on track. So Hale says no, he sees a split up coming here. Larry Diamond makes a nod to that same possibility. What do you see?
First, I think we need to understand you're not going to persuade the insurgents, the people who are actually doing the fighting. You're not going to include them in a government. They're going to have to be defeated militarily, and some may or may not, if there are amnesties or other programs, participate. When we talk about the split between Sunni and Shiite and other minorities, we also need to remember that most of these ethnic estimates are more than 20 years old. We really don't know what the percentages are. We don't know how people will vote. We'll get some indication after time. But to the extent we do know, when we talk about both the Sunni triangle and the so-called Triangle of Death and all of Al-Anbar province, we're talking about roughly 6% of the population of Iraq. If you really believe in the most recent CIA estimates, with the Kurds at 15% and the Shiites at around 65%, you're talking about elections which presumably are inclusive for about 80% of the population. So is this going to be smooth or all-inclusive in this election? No. Why do the Shiites join? The Sunnis. They join because the government offers those who are willing to join incentives, and also because they see if they're going to get power, if they're going to get wealth, they have to join. So this is both the carrot and the stick, and the election and the military actions are going to deal with this. The whole idea that somehow we could have a smooth, polite process of power sharing is simply something that can't happen in this country. It's going to be a mixture of struggle and co-opting people, and it is going to be difficult, and it's going to take time, and there may be additional clashes in the interim. But if we're going to define success, we also have to define things in realistic terms.
And it sounds like you're looking at a fairly modest definition there, and one that's played out somewhere along the rim of a possible split-up if it doesn't work.
I don't think you're going to get a split-up simply because there are several factors to remember here. One, at least at present, in the Sunni areas, there isn't any oil. To the extent there was an economy in most of the areas which have a high level of insurgency, it was an artificial economy created by Saddam Hussein, a lot of it in villages or small towns, which can never stand on their own and which have no way of generating revenue or competing. You can have a significant insurgency. You can have high levels of terrorism. But the fact is that with most Sunnis actually in Mosul or in Baghdad, and a Shiite majority, certainly, in Baghdad, this split is a lot harder to actually describe and make real than it is to sort of talk about in broad rhetorical terms.
Larry Diamond, let me ask you, you worked with the Coalition Provisional Authority. A lot is going to hang on the reported numbers of people who vote and how they vote, and as you've both said, who votes, what portion of Sunnis, what portion of Shia, Kurds, and so on. There is a remarkably small number of international observers reported on hand for this. The last number I saw was 29, very small for a country of this size. What about the simple reporting of voter turnout and the vote itself? Are there systems in place for that to be seen as legitimate, credible, honest? It's clearly someone could have an interest in manipulating even the report of how many people vote.
Well, I would say not just someone, but lots of actors will have an overwhelming interest in inflating the number of voters who turned out, and basically, if I can put it baldly, in stuffing ballot boxes. Since the number of seats that are accorded each list will be, as I said, directly proportional to their share of the national vote.
Right.
The more votes, the more seats.
And the more legitimacy.
Not necessarily. The more power, but that's different than legitimacy. The more seats, the more power in the National Assembly. But I think legitimacy is best viewed as something that will apply to the overall result and the overall parliament or not, maybe to some larger collections of actors, but not just to
individual interests,
party or candidate.
Right. So what about the credibility of the vote, the security of the count, the accuracy, the honesty?
Let me say, Tom, I have worried about this for a long time, and it's why I was pushing, and many of my colleagues in the CPA last year, for very far-reaching demobilization of the militias, not just the insurgents, but the militias of parties who've been in the system and have not been making violence, because I think of the potential for them to engage in electoral malpractices. And this is a black hole. We don't have any idea of what's going to go on an election day and how clean it's going to be, or how much subject to fraud. There will be probably very few domestic election monitors deployed in the country because of the violence and disorganization as well, not to mention the international observers. It could be a long time, if ever, before we're able to assess the degree of electoral fraud.
When you say militias, Muqtada al-Sadr comes to mind. And
talking about, in particular, groups like the Badr Organization of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is one of the lead parties within the United Iraqi Alliance. I would note as well that the two Kurdish parties, democratically inclined though they have been, and in alliance now with one another though they are, have by far the strongest militias in the country, and a very powerful incentive to ensure the largest possible vote from Kurdistan.
So stuff those boxes, and who's going to know with so few observers on hand? Herb is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Herb. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to commend Mr. Diamond on his very astute analysis of the situation there. I've not heard that elsewhere, and I wish somebody in Washington was listening to what he had to say. Mm-hmm. Apparently, they haven't been. My point was that there is simply no institutional basis for the success of the elections. That is, there isn't a national entity. Iraq is the Yugoslavia of the Middle East, with a lot of conflicting interests involved.
Sure.
And no natural center of gravity.
Except the oil wells, Anthony Cordesman points out.
I think that's academic, because most people simply don't participate in the wealth that those things generate. But I would make one further point.
Yes, please.
That is that the old Soviet Union between 1940 and 1980, by my count, from Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania in 1940 to Afghanistan in 1980, took over 42 countries successfully. Didn't occupy them, but it certainly administered them for locally grown communists. When they overthrew a country, such as they did in Cuba, for example.
You know, what's the analogy you're drawing there?
The thing is that they would launch a government in exile and then develop the military capability and go in and overthrow the existing government.
Get explicit. What do you mean?
Well, what I'm saying is we should have had a government in exile before we ever got in there, you know, an Iraqi government in exile. And a governmental structure to go in place. You have to have an institutional basis for government. And absent that, all of the people that participate in the election, either pre or post-election, are simply targets.
We've got it. Herb, Anthony Cordesman, of course, it's easy to look backwards and a little appalling to look backwards. But Herb's saying without more institution there in the first place, the election can't be credible, won't achieve what's wanted. What's the option?
Well, first, there isn't any option. Either you really have the election or you lose the Shiites, which is a disaster of much more serious proportions. Second, you have four parties which are probably going to dominate this. One is the list of the Sistani, which is a Shiite coalition. Another is the Kurdish coalition. You have another list under the prime minister and a fourth under the president. And these are relatively well understood. And I think, first, these figures about international observers, you have to understand that the way that this election was structured was to create Iraqi election officials simply because it was clear from the start you weren't going to get the observers.
The international folks afraid to come in.
So you train something like 1,000 core election officials and 6,000 provincial officials, and you're actually talking about something on the order of 5,000 polling centers, which are tied to a registration system which has worked fairly well. Now, Larry is correct. A lot of things can go wrong, but a lot of things can go right as well. And in third world elections, having problems in ballots, shall we say, are more the rule than the exception. Where things really get to be the issue is not some sort of purity of the elections or inclusiveness, because you can't have it. There really won't be that many polling places in Al-Anbar, even if they wanted to vote.
Right, and Fallujah's only got a tiny fraction of its population even living there after the...
Which may actually mean more Sunnis vote in other areas. But the key point here is really that it's going to be whether people can govern, whether out of this election comes something that the Iraqi people find is convincing and capable of governing. Now, those institutions are going to have to be developed one way or another. They couldn't have been created in advance. And it's going to be up to the Iraqis who are elected to see whether they can make it work or dissolve and argue with each other. But we're sitting here trying to make judgments about a process which is admittedly very uncertain. And I think we're doing it in terms of Western standards for elections, which are by and large irrelevant in this country.
Larry Diamond, how about it? Is it enough to get the form of the election out there at this point, you know, with a lot of bad options, at least to be able to point to the fact that a rare thing has happened, a vote has taken place? Might it be possible to use that, however tenuous, as the foundation to build on?
Yeah, I mean, of course, something is better than nothing in this regard. And look, when you compare it against the last election that Iraq had, in which one presidential candidate was reported to have won 100% of the vote, almost
Mr.
anything.
Mr. Saddam Hussein.
Yes, almost anything is going to look better in terms of democracy. I think it can't be perfect. We all know that. Even if there's moderate amounts of fraud and ballot box stuffing, you know, we can probably get some sense from the competing parties about how gross the violations were. My main concern, I'm going to repeat it again and disagree with just one thing that Tony Cordesman said. My main concern is with the degree to which the Sunni sections of the country, and he's right, we can't know what their relative population balance is, may be underrepresented. And the element of which I disagree, which I think almost everybody is missing in this, is that repeatedly, over the last 15 months, actors associated with the insurgency, religious and secular, people associated with the Ba'ath Party and people who are by no means Ba'athist.
20 seconds, give it to us, Mr. Diamond.
Have been sending signals that they want to talk to the United States. And I think we have missed opportunities to bring these people into the political process.
Well, there's something to think about on the other side of the election. We may need to be reaching out there. With that, we're out of time, but we're very grateful to both of you for being with us tonight. Larry Diamond in California at the Hoover Institution, thank you for joining us tonight.
Pleasure.
And Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.